Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the real cost of the things we buy and sell? Oscar Wilde wrote in The Picture of Dorian Gray that nowadays people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. The novel was published in 1890, but my guest today is convinced and concerned that the aphorism is just as true today. Raj Patel is an academic, an activist, and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. His new book is called The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Raj, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
What is the difference between price and value?
Price is pretty straightforward, and that's why Oscar Wilde was pointing to the fact that people understand that the price is what you are charged for something. The shorthand for it is it's the meeting point between supply and demand. But value is something that can be at once very personal and very public, that can exceed the price of something. So, for example, there are things that have values that we can't put a price on, like human life, for instance. And there's a systematic mismatch between what we pay for goods and services in the world that we live in today, and the way that if we were given a choice, we might otherwise value them. And it's that distinction that I'm trying to get at in the book.
Well, the idea here is that markets typically fail to comprehend social value. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I mean, let's have a concrete example. Let's say that the price of a hamburger, and researchers, oddly enough, in India a few years ago, did some math, and they figured that if a hamburger was grown on land that used to be rainforest, then by turning that land into pasture for cows, you lose a lot of the ecological services that land provides, and by doing that, you lose biodiversity, you lose the oxygen that's being produced, you lose its place in the water cycle, and a range of other things. And if you put a dollar value to what it is that's lost, these researchers calculated that a hamburger could cost upward of $200. Those are just the costs of the environment that don't factor into the price of a hamburger. There are social costs to do with, for example, health in the consuming of hamburgers and of you know, what features as part of the American diet, that leads to very high healthcare costs. Indeed. I mean, in the United States today, one in five healthcare dollars is spent looking after someone with diabetes. That's, you know, $175 billion that again, doesn't feature in the price we pay for something at the checkout, but it's a price that we pay sooner or later.
Assuming that we cultivate the will to do so, is it possible to really put the right price on everything and not counting things that can't be calculated, like human life, as you mentioned, but just commodities?
I think that we can approximate some of the costs. I mean, we already have ways of thinking about how to pay for the damage that we've caused. And there was a study in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that basically totted up the damage that we in rich countries have caused people in poor countries by the way that we consume. And if you just look at the damage to the ozone layer, to climate change, to the seas through overfishing, through mangroves, mangrove deforestation, and a couple of other things. You come up with a sum that is a quantity that's very real, that we owe poor countries $5 trillion for the way that we've damaged their resources over the past 40 years. So to some extent, yes, we can come up with a first approximation of what that debt is and what the costs are. But in order to get a much truer sense of the value of things, we can't just lock a bunch of economists in a room and hope that they will figure out the right number. As I say in the book, economics is about choices, but it's never said who gets to make those choices. And we, as citizens, need to be making choices about what we value, about what we prioritize, and about how we want to pay for the environmental and social costs. And how we want to value those social costs that are in the goods and services that make up our commodities. So it's possible to get close, but in order to have a true value, I mean, a true value is just what we think it is. And in order for us to express what we think it is, We need to get around a table and discuss it democratically.
So, Raj, in the current system, and you and I both live in democracies, who's making the rules and the systems that determine how our resources are exploited and how they're spent and how they're shared?
Well, I mean, at the moment, although we live in democracies and we go through the rituals of voting every whatever it is, 2 to 4 years, I mean, essentially what we live in is a complainocracy, where we, when we're upset with one group of people who are who have disappointed us, we can kick them out and have another group of people who will pursue more or less the same policy. I think this is one of the things that we've come to realize through, you know, through the past decade of government, is that private sector interests and the government are increasingly close and increasingly remote from ordinary citizens. And so when you look at the economic policies that have been pursued through this recession, for example, they've been remarkably similar from one administration to the next. And that's because the advisors, when it comes to economic policy, pass through the revolving door, through Wall Street, and through, you know, and through government. And what we're seeing is that in many ways, the policies that make and value our world are not really being set by ordinary citizens, but are being set by industry and by Wall Street.
Well, let's talk about how all this happened, because in your analysis, markets as we know them today are not nearly as timeless or organic as they would seem to be. How did modern-style market economics come to be?
Well, you're right, Chris, to say that there is something odd about markets today. I mean, human history has always had the phenomenon of exchange. An exchange is a good thing, and markets offer a venue in which people can negotiate and come to trust one another and cooperate. So it's not that markets are a problem, but the trouble is that that there are increasingly strange commodities that appear in that market. And one of the things I do is in the book is just show how recent it is that we've started buying and selling labor and buying and selling land. Because, I mean, really, this is a phenomenon that's what, 400 years old in its contemporary form. Human civilization has done very well without the phenomenon of rent and wages. But it's really the economic system that was catalyzed by people being kicked off their land in rural areas, having to work in cities, having to sell their labor, and that process brought about what we're now living through in terms of modern capitalism. But it is very, very new historically, really only 400 years old.
So if there's nothing inherently natural about the way we buy and sell for profit and we sell things like land and labor, is there a way to create profit without causing harm somewhere down the line?
Well, I mean, I think there's a way of creating value. I think there's a way of creating benefit. I mean, profit, it seems to me, is very much tied up with what it is that's left over after you underpay workers and after you abuse the environment. I think that there is a way for money to be, for value to be created by using resources sustainably and by paying people a living wage. But in order to do that, we do need to regulate and constrain markets a lot more than we do at the moment, in order that people do get paid a living wage and that the environment is maintained so that future generations have a planet that's worth living on. And I mean, this isn't to say, that markets have no role in a just and fair economy, but it means that in order for markets to function fairly and justly, we need to have before markets function, have prioritized and have valued each other's work and labor and also the environment around it.
I think it's interesting that you bring up the idea of regulating and restraining markets, because you see free markets as incredibly restrictive when viewed from a broader perspective than simply profit and loss. Will you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. I mean, there's a thought experiment that the late Oxford philosopher Jerry Cohen has, and I love this experiment. But basically, I mean, what Jerry Cohen was saying is, if you think that markets are about freedom, if you think free market is about liberty, then imagine a world where everyone is given tickets at random, and these tickets have written upon them things that you can do. You can have your leg patched up if you break it when you're riding a bicycle. You can go visit your aunt. You can go for a holiday somewhere. Now, on these tickets are distributed at random, and you don't have to do what's written on these tickets. But you can. If you have a ticket that says you can go visit your aunt, you can go visit your aunt. If you don't have a ticket that says you can visit your aunt, then you can't. And if you try to, then the police will intervene. And then what Jerry Cohen says is, look, what these tickets are rights. You know, they're freedoms, in a sense. We would say that in this world, if people didn't have tickets or didn't have many tickets, they would be less free than people who had a lot of tickets. So, you know, everyone's kind of head nodding so far. That makes sense. You know, more tickets, more freedom. But then what Jerry Cohen says is, well, look, what these tickets are is just another way of talking about money. Money is, you know, the more money you have, the more free you are to be able to, you know, go see your aunt or go on a holiday or have health care. And in a free market, the freedom is substantially constrained for people who are born without money, who are born without or who are in various ways deprived of cash. So in other words, in a free market, for the poorest people and for those living below the average wage, there's substantially less freedom. And I think that's a point that's often forgotten, that for poor people in a free market, freedom is just another word for nothing that they can afford.
Of course, there are people who will argue that lack of tickets, a lack of money, is what drives people to productive labor. Where's the disconnect there?
Well, I mean, to make that argument is already to justify, you know, that it's unfortunate that people are born into circumstances, that, you know, that we have children who are born into poverty, but those children will be particularly urged to work hard as opposed to their rich counterparts who will be able to, you know, lie back in their pools. So there's a sort of an injustice there built into the argument. But the fact is that if you look at mobility, if you look at class mobility, the possibilities for poor children to become rich, there's much less class mobility in the United States and around the world than there ever used to be. And so while we have this argument about, well, you know, poverty is going to make people work harder, that's an argument that's both unjust, and it's not true that hard work by itself will bring about a just outcome. So on both counts, that argument's kind of flawed.
You know, it's a fascinating point because Americans sort of pride ourselves in living in what we consider to be a classless society, in that it is possible to go from the lowest echelons to the highest, but it just doesn't happen very often in practical application.
No, it's sad. I mean, when President Obama was elected, that seemed to give the lie to the naysayers who said that it couldn't happen in America. And I think that was a very proud moment, justifiably, for the United States. But it was also an exceptional moment. And in the main, in terms of poverty in the United States, if you're born into poverty, that's very likely where your children will end up, no matter how hard you work. And particularly now that there's a dismantling of the safety nets that used to catch people from situations of extreme poverty, and a certain sort of walking away from the commitments to redress injustices in the past, I think that it's going to be much, much harder for children born into poverty in the United States to make a go of it.
Do you think that people who profit from the system or benefit from the system as it exists today are sort of intentionally blind to why it doesn't work for everyone else?
I don't think it intentionally blind is right. I mean, when you look at, say, the bankers, or if you look at people who are working in the finance industry, I don't imagine that, you know, every day they cackle to themselves and they sit in their black swivel chairs stroking white cats, sort of pondering the downfall of the working poor. I mean, obviously, we've heard some exposés recently where that kind of nefarious activity does happen. But in the main, you know, I think what we have is a case of good people doing bad things. And that's inherent to the kind of rules that we've set up. I mean, if you look at the way that corporations are meant to behave, for example, what they're meant to do is bring home profit for their shareholders every quarter. Someone who doesn't do that, a CEO that doesn't care about the bottom line over, you know, the welfare of the families that he's abusing, is going to be kicked out of his job. So
let me have you stop right there, Raj. We need to take a quick break.
Okay.
My guest is Raj Patel. His new book is called The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is academic and activist Raj Patel. He's a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. His new book is called The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And before the break, you were telling us about the fact that it's not necessarily a matter of the haves sitting around thumbing their noses at the plight of the have-nots.
No, that's right. And I spoke at a rate of knots to try and get that in before the break. But essentially, I mean, I think this is about the rules of the game that we've set up. And any corporation that doesn't bring home a profit is going to have some reorganization at the top of that corporation. And so what we have is a sort of pyramid of people who are being driven to maximize profit, even if that means that they have to check in their consciences at the door. I mean, I don't imagine people gladly make the tough decision to maximize profit over environmental sustainability, for example. And I've spoken to some lovely people who are head of sustainability or of in some ways sort of maximizing business ethics at corporations. But even they admit that if it's a choice between making good happen and bringing a higher bottom line, the bottom line will always win.
So what kinds of measurements do we need to apply to our own consumption habits as individuals in order to really understand value?
Well, I mean, I think, it's important for us to appreciate where things come from. Food is perhaps the easiest way of appreciating that. I mean, we know that there are certain kinds of foods that are entirely unsustainable, that do involve deforestation in their manufacture, that come from very, very far away, that are profligate in their use of fertilizers in terms of water. The thing is, it's very hard to put a dollar value on all of these things. And so but one of the things we can do, rather than hope that someone will come up with the right kind of indicator, is to be proactive about changing the way, for example, that we eat. We can become more knowledgeable about the way things are grown by, for example, growing them ourselves. And if we can't grow food ourselves, we can certainly ask at a farmer's market about how the food was grown and to ensure that the workers were well paid, that the workers were allowed to form a union if they wanted to. These kinds of things. So it is possible through smart consumption to become closer to the costs and the benefits of food in ways that don't really involve monetary transactions, but do involve a certain social interaction. I think that there's also a limit to the way that we can consume our way out of this problem. I mean, I think it's a fantasy to believe that we can together change the world by shopping. Of course, don't get me wrong. I mean, I buy fair trade coffee because, the alternative to fair trade is, sort of blood on your beans coffee, just exploitative coffee, and no one wants that. But at the same time, I think that one of the arguments I'm making is around how mere consumption doesn't change the structures of power that underwrite that consumption. And what we need to be doing is becoming not better consumers, though we need to do that, but also better citizens.
I want to talk about the fact that economists almost universally failed to predict the recession that's hurt so many people around the world. What did they miss that they ought to have seen?
I think that there were economists who were very much on top of the recession. I mean, there were economists who saw the housing bubble coming a long way off. And I think that what was missed, I mean, what got their voices got drowned out by we could term irrational exuberance. John Maynard Keynes, the late British economist, called animal spirits, where there was a certain herd mentality, but believing that the economy could continue to grow forever. And there were assurances coming from the federal government and from the boardrooms of the most powerful companies that no, this wasn't a bubble, and assets were correctly priced, and it was just a few economists who were sort of in the wilderness who were in fact pointing out that there was no way that the housing bubble, the houses were correctly priced given the rental market and what have you. So what that should alert people to is the fact that Actually, you know, economics isn't a monolithic science. There are a lot of different voices there. But unfortunately, those in the mainstream have been the ones who've been shaping our economic policy. And Alan Greenspan, for example, was one of the people saying, no, everything is fine. And it was very interesting in 2008, in October, when he was in front of the House Oversight Committee. He sort of came up and he said, he was forced to admit that there was a flaw in his model, that there was a problem with the way that he'd been approaching free markets as the best of all possible worlds. And I think we failed to appreciate that. I mean, if the Pope suddenly sort of shrugged his shoulders and said, yeah, you know what, I just made this whole God thing up. Or, you know, if the Dalai Lama just sort of picked up a machine gun and said, no, actually, violence does solve problems. we would be appalled, and we'd certainly hear no end of that. But when Alan Greenspan says, yeah, you know, my ideology that I've been believed in for 40 years turns out to be false. Well, you know, I don't think any of us quite understand how to comprehend how big an admission of failure that is.
One of the things that Greenspan said to explain why he got it so wrong was that many of the models that told us that we would continue to prosper took really only the recent boom decades into account.
Well, yes, I mean, there's a word for that kind of argument. What he had was a garbage in, garbage out argument, which is that the model that he was functioning with was essentially okay, but they weren't looking far enough back for the data. But Henry Waxman on that panel pushed him back and said, no, actually, you know, I mean, Greenspan was forced to admit that it wasn't just a problem in data, but a problem in the very functioning of the markets that he'd believed in for 40 years. So, yes, I mean, although Greenspan opened by saying that, yes, it was just a problem with data, in the end, he was forced to make a far more profound admission.
Raj Patel is my guest. His new book is called The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Raj, you've observed recently that banks that insert themselves deeply into the workings of government are the ones that tend to prosper. Will you talk about that phenomenon?
Well, I mean, very interesting to me that Goldman Sachs, for example, last year paid out record bonuses. It seems to be a sort of an ongoing phenomenon, one that's been commented on in a range of financial papers, that whenever the government announces a policy, mysteriously Goldman Sachs has managed to come up with a way around that policy that maintains its profits and maximizes its returns, particularly for the people who are working there. And in a sense, that's not surprising. I mean, if you look at the people advising the president and the calls that are made from the Treasury to Wall Street, it's pretty clear that Wall Street has an almost direct line into the economic policy of that's being shaped in this country. When you see that Larry Summers, for example, is the who heads the Council of the President's Economic Advisers. When you see that he's been working on Wall Street for a while as a consultant, and when you see the spider's web of connections between the Treasury and Wall Street, it's not terribly surprising to see that while more and more Americans are losing their jobs, and more Americans are going hungry, by the way. I mean, in 2008, 49 million Americans were food insecure in that year. And yet, immediately, the year after that, what you see is that Goldman Sachs is making these record bonus payouts. And I think that should be a fairly clear warning sign that the way our economic policy is made is anything but democratic.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Nick in Arlington. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, the comment I have is just that while I recognize the fact that value is often not associated with price in today's market, it's principally because the market forces don't recognize the value proposition. Examples like producing enormous amounts of carcinogens or of carbon damage. But if we were to adjust that by having the market recognize those inherent costs, that is a total cradle-grave cost or something, then value and price close. It would seem to me the equation of using regulation is the way to do that is probably an extremely poor form. Any of the overregulated economies that we see have all failed in one way or another. Examples like the communist bloc, which supposedly regulated from cradle to grave with governmental influence, were total failures.
What do you think about that, Raj?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, let's look at a very concrete example and look at carbon trading, for example. And the story here is that we all know that we're producing a great deal more carbon dioxide than is sustainable for the planet. And the question is how to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that we produce in a sustainable way. Now, the solution that's on the table is precisely to create a market in carbon so that the market can go figure out exactly how best to value a ton of carbon and then to reduce it. The trouble is that when you see cap and trade systems at play, and the European Union has had one for a little while, you'll see that it's an abject failure. What you see is that through cap and trade, and also through the sort of huckstering that's been going on behind the scenes in the economy, you have large polluters and large banks making a great deal of money out of these carbon trading schemes. And the net result is that carbon emissions don't go down. I mean, the reason they've gone down recently is because of the recession. In the book, I quote one of the traders at Citibank who says, look, the winners from this are polluters who got to pollute more, banks and traders who made a great deal of money, and, of course, the general public were out of pocket. So it's not clear to me that markets are able to internalize these externalities, to pay for the damage that they cause, particularly given the way that our political system is set up. I think that actually just setting a cap on pollution has proven to be a very effective way of reducing pollution. But marketizing pollution has tended to be pretty much a failure.
Does an equitable distribution of resources and sustainable environmental economics, do they require a sort of universal altruism to work?
No, well, not at all. I mean, it's important to remember that we're seeing more and more that if you care about being happy, for example, if you care about welfare, and at the end of the day, accumulating money is meant to be a route towards everyone being happier. But what we're seeing in increasing amount of research is pointing towards the fact that happier societies are ones where there are more equitable distributions of resources. In other words, if you only care about making yourself happier, and if you want to live in a safer society just purely for yourself, out of pure self-interest, then the smart thing to do is to ensure that there is a just and more equitable thing to do. In other words, you can leverage a more just and equitable society from a proposition that involves pure selfishness. On the other hand, it's important to remember that we're not purely selfish animals, although modern economic theory would like to pretend that we are driven purely by greed. It turns out that we are cooperative animals, that we are capable of altruism. We're not purely altruistic. We're not purely anything. But the trouble is that the way that markets socialize us today encourages us to be individual, atomistic, and greedy. And I think we do need to foster and encourage our more benign, more cooperative, and more altruistic sides in order to make a better society and to make us happier.
You alluded to this earlier, but I want to talk a little bit more about the Obama administration's response to troubling conditions both in the U.S. and in the broader world. You haven't really seen anything so far that tells you that his approach is fundamentally different or somehow more effective than his predecessors.
Well, no. In terms of economic policy, there were a number of choices that could have been made around the bailout, for example. Other uses of that money, ways in which the loans could have been guaranteed to consumers, people could have been kept in their homes rather than being kicked out. And those were choices, tough choices, that the administration chose not to make. And that, I think, is a great disappointment to everyone who cared about surviving this economic storm, whether on the left or on the right. I think that there's far more continuity between the two administrations than the new administration would like to pretend.
Is it possible to both preserve and reform capitalist economies?
I think that It depends what you mean by capitalism. I mean, if we're talking about the ongoing exploitation and the lack of freedom that our current capitalist economies provide, then I don't think that's worth preserving. I don't think that there's anything worthwhile in economies that drive us towards less freedom, less choice, less liberty. But I think it is possible to be able to create value and to be able to have market exchanges. I think that's tremendously important. But what it requires is for us to get off the bench. And I think that this is the bit that's hardest for us to imagine. I think that we've been so soaked in this the ideology of free markets that we forget that there might be other ways of valuing the world. And that's disappointing, because in fact there used to be and there continue to be other ways of valuing the world. And you don't have to be a sort of bomb-throwing radical to see these other ways. I mean, in fact, the Nobel Prize in Economics last year was shared in part by Eleanor Ostrom, who is an economist at the University of Indiana, who has been whose work on the commons is a tremendously exciting way of thinking about other ways in which we can value the world around us that aren't about markets, but are about getting together as communities, putting limits on the amount that we consume, but also being freer as a result of having a more equitable distribution of resources.
Raj Patel is my guest. He's an academic and activist and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. His new book is called The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Raj Patel. His new book is called The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the role of democracy in reshaping market economies. Is it not possible that participants in those democracies, particularly those in the developed world where people tend to be relatively prosperous, would choose old-style capitalism as opposed to anything new?
Well, it depends who you ask. I mean, as I say, we've been talking about the fact that nearly, 50 million Americans, more or less, went hungry in 2008. I mean, the reason they go hungry is not because of a shortage of food. There was more than enough food in 2008 to feed everyone. But the reason that people went hungry was because the way that food is distributed is through the market. And the market is, those too poor to be able to buy food simply don't get to eat. So for them, in other words, for one in six Americans, things aren't working out at all well, and of course we're expected to see the unemployment rate rising throughout this year, through next year as well. So I think that there are increasing numbers of Americans who are very skeptical about the power of capitalism to be able to deliver what it is that's been promised. And around the world, in survey after survey, you're seeing an increasing distrust of the system that people have been sold on for the past 20, 30 years.
What are the most effective emerging movements towards sustainable government and market policies that you've seen?
Well, I mean, I'm excited by a range of organizations in the United States and elsewhere that offer some very promising alternatives to the market in terms of valuing things. I mean, for example, I mean, in classical Athenian democracy, with all its problems, democracy in Athens involved 6,000 citizens being picked at random, so there were no elections in Athenian democracy. Instead, you had 6,000 people picked at random to run the city for a year, and after their term was up, another 6,000 were picked at random. Now, people would think, oh, well, you know, that's all good for Athens, but, you know, you need to be educated, and you need to be, that works only in times where people sort of wear white cloths and laurels on their heads. But you're seeing similar kinds of initiatives flourishing in developing countries today. So something like participatory budgeting, which you see which started in Brazil, is, I think, very exciting. And the idea here is that a city government has money to spend, and it should be citizens who decide where that money goes. And so there are meetings in some of the poorest areas in the cities of Brazil, where people decide how it is that the government budget is going to be divided up. And that's a very interesting kind of direct democracy and of people absolutely taking charge of their democracies and of value that I think we could learn from in this country. Because, in that instance, it's some of the poorest people making some of the most sophisticated decisions, living with the consequences, learning from it, and doing a very good job. Those kinds of experiences of direct democracy are ones that I think we have much less contact with, and I think a very exciting model.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Mark in Tyler. Hello, Mark.
Hello. I was wondering if he could talk about the idea that most capitalist economies are based on growth, and is the idea of a no-growth economy, is that even possible?
Well, thanks very much, Mark. It's a very good question. And I think what we're seeing, again, is an efflorescence of models that look not at growth rates, but at steady state flows, where it is possible for we maintain a balance between our consumption of resources and the throughput of that resources that isn't about exploiting the world anew in a sort of perpetual a perpetual rampage into the natural world, trying to turn all of it into a commodity or one form or another, but it instead moves us towards ways of valuing and ways of setting up economies that are cycles rather than that are sort of perpetual sort of circuits of expansion. So yes, there are models to be able to help us reach a steady state of economics, but it will mean redistribution so that we're all basically on the same page, and it will mean us changing our expectations about what we can expect and three-car households and the massive overconsumption that we have at the moment. It's very clear that that's not sustainable. We don't have many more. We only have one planet, and it would take several planets. It would take six planets, for example, to produce the amount of meat that the average American consumption demands if everyone were going to consume the same as Americans. We only have one planet. We need to think about ways of using it equitably. And the perpetual growth model that we have at the moment is not sustainable in any way.
We have an email here from Paul who says, everyone's theory works when they're proposing that theory. However, once implemented on a large scale over a consistent period of time, reality has a brutal way of commenting on one's theories. Can you point us to some large-scale, long-term, successful, naturally flourishing and growing examples of your ideas?
Well, I mean, we've got, there was a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that looked at 80 different forest communities, for example. And in that study, what was found was that they were looking at how when forest communities are allowed to govern themselves and to use resources autonomously, how well forest communities did. And the result was that if you give forest communities, which have been around for decades, centuries, millennia, if you give those communities access to forests and give them the autonomy they need to be able to govern themselves, then those forest communities do much better in terms of development, and they sequester much more carbon. In other words, that they don't exploit the forest, but they maintain the forest way better than if you bring the government in or the private sector in. So I'm very pleased to answer that question, because I think if we look at reality, if we look at the examples that are alive and well today, we can find some amazing examples of sustainability that we need to learn from.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the line to Fort Worth and speak with Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Mr. Patel. I have a question regarding something you said earlier, how our current selling labor kind of model is only about 400 years old, so it's pretty recent in history. And I'm reading Genesis in the Old Testament right now, and, you know, slavery is referenced so much that it's, you know, obviously was so accepted, you know, in antiquity and for thousands of years. And I want to know if there was ever a time in history in which people, you know, were really maybe allowed to be their own producers, where they weren't either subjugated by slavery or fiefdom, or had to sell their labor. And I'll take my response off the phone. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amanda. Yes, you're right. I mean, slavery is very old, and sadly, of course, it's very new. I mean, it would be a mistake to imagine that slavery has disappeared. And in the book, I write about how slavery is sadly alive here in the United States, or modern day slavery, and how in southern Florida, for example, tomato pickers have been freed from conditions of modern day slavery in their thousands since 1997. So, sadly, the slavery isn't confined only to the period of the Bible. It's still ongoing. But I think what one needs to do is look at not just different periods of history, but also different parts of the world. I mean, if you look, for example, at the Zapatistas in southern Mexico, you'll see there communities of people who are very much autonomous in the sense of governing themselves. It's certainly true that the people are still working and working very hard there. But there's considerably more freedom in communities like that, or in the settlements in Brazil of the a group called the MST, which I write about a little bit as well. So there are examples around today. I'm not aware of a period in history where there was some sort of perfect society, and I don't think that there will ever be a perfect society. But I think our task is to learn from the societies that we know about and to make our society always a little less perfect.
Let's go next.
A little less imperfect. Sorry.
Let's go next on the line to Flower Mound, and we'll speak with San. Hi, San.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering, Mr. Patel, how it would be possible for average citizens to be able to take our government back from lobbyists and high-powered interest groups such as Wall Street, so that the government can work for everyone as opposed to just a few. And I've noticed a trend over the last 20 years where it's just slowly been heading to this to the disaster we had in 06. And how can we scale that back, and what can we do?
Oh, that's a great question. I think, you know, there's a number of things that we can do. I think the minute we realize just how powerful we are, there's no end of things that we can do. I mean, we can take our money back from Wall Street and put our money in local credit unions rather than the big banks, for instance. But we can do more than just consume more wisely or invest more wisely. And one of the examples I'm really excited about here in the United States is an efflorescence of groups called food policy councils, and there are now nearly 100 of them in North America. And these are organizations where it's local government and citizens and businesses, farmers, getting together and trying to figure out how to make hunger in America go away. And the way they do that is by very creatively thinking about the root causes of hunger, about tackling poverty in America, but also about making food available in poor communities, ways of taking public land and using that for the growing of food, and through a process of this democratic engagement and deliberation, you start having these amazing examples of people actually taking their local government back. Now, that's very far from taking back the White House, but of course, democracy doesn't trickle down; it always bubbles up. And I think the community organizations that are around us, that, you know, that are in our churches, in our schools, in our municipalities, is a first step to be able to reclaim the federal government. I don't think anyone can reclaim the federal government by themselves. The interests that are there are far too powerful. But I think that by organizing locally and systematically, we can start to reclaim a government and start to bring that federal government back. And in the meantime, we can certainly start disinvesting and disengaging from the businesses that have rather captured that government.
So even if we wanted to, we couldn't change the way we do things overnight, and perhaps we shouldn't change it overnight. Mm. In an ideal world, though, Raj, how do you imagine gradual changes would build upon each other?
Well, I mean, I think we need to learn from our mistakes. I mean, I think that there are going to be mistakes made. And the trouble is that the mistakes that have been made so far, the people who make those mistakes manage to shuffle off those consequences onto other people. And what we need is to be creating systems of democracy where we get to live with the consequences of our actions. I do think that sort of the gradual change of more organizing at a community level to, for example, around food or around education or around whatever issue it is that makes you passionate, is a stepping stone to actually reclaiming that democracy. So, I mean, it's not as if once we, once we banish hunger from our communities, we all sort of give up and go home. We use that as a stepping stone to eradicating poverty, to ensuring that everyone has good, green, and sustainable jobs in our community. I think that the community organizing that's already flourishing right now, even in the midst of this recession, is the first step in a path that leads to more sustainable government.
Do you expect the state of the economy right now to catalyze action to a greater degree than when everybody was, if you'll pardon the expression, fat and happy?
I think absolutely, Chris. I mean, it's true that there's a lot more organizing of necessity right now. I'm hearing, up and down the country, more people saying, well, how did we get here? Why is it that we're in such a mess? Because I thought 2 years ago we were fat and happy and everything was fine. That questioning is also an opening, a moment in which we can start thinking slightly differently. And in fact, that's why I wrote The Value of Nothing right now, is to be able to answer some of the questions about, well, this is how we got here, and this is what we need. Here are the options that we have in order to be able to get us out of this mess.
Raj Patel is an academic, an activist, and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. His newest book is called The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Raj, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.